Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to The Deal Room, where every week we talk specifically about all things corporate finance, from the biggest M&A and PE deals to the strategy that drives business decision making. We aim to bring what you learn in the classroom to life with real world examples, and hopefully at the same time have some fun with it. So let's dive in. Okay, so we have, as usual, three items on the docket, which we're going to use as our real stories happening right now, acting as a vehicle to hopefully educate across some different areas of corporate finance. And the first one is going to be more pure play in the M&A space, because we've had an announcement of one of the biggest, well, I think the biggest transaction year to date, which was Capital One Discovery. So we can talk about that deal. Stephen can provide all the color on the rationale from the M&A perspective, and then also the big question of antitrust given the significance of this deal. And then we're going to look at the fast fashion retailer Shein and a possible London IPO. I think when I saw that headline, I was like, what? London's going to win an IPO? That can't be right. There must be something else bubbling under the surface for sure. And I'm sure that there is, that Stephen will uncover. And then thirdly, the role of an activist investor. And I love that term, mainly because I always think of this person like in black clothing, wielding like the red saber, chopping up a company and acting as like the dark force. But I just wonder, is that always true? And there's a good story at the moment involving Disney. And I think you've also got a good example, Stephen, on Peloton as well, that we can use to describe that situation. So yeah, first of all, this big deal then, Capital One Discovery, what's going on?
Yeah, thanks, Anne. This deal was announced a couple of weeks ago now, and it has been very well covered. But I thought it was just so useful to pick up on this from a fundamental deal rationale perspective. You know, we've spoken a lot previously about why companies do M&A. This is a really, really good example of that. And then obviously talk a little bit about antitrust and whether this thing is going to get blocked, because it is a massive deal. Capital One, quote unquote, acquiring Discovery. I mean, it's a merger more than anything. It's an all-stock deal, $35 billion. The shareholders of Capital One will own 60% of the entity, and the shareholders of Discover will own 40%. But just taking a little step back, because this can get a little bit complicated, I just want to kind of try and paint the picture of the difference between the two companies. So Capital One, less known maybe in Europe than it is in the States. Capital One is one of the biggest providers of credit cards to consumers, to retail consumers in the US. So it's a B2C, business to consumer. Its famous advert, their slogan is, "What's in your wallet?" Taylor Swift getting paid $8 million for a recent ad campaign I read. So it's very much focused on getting people using the Capital One credit card. Now, that's really important because Discover, yes, it does have its own card network. It does have its own Discover cards, but it is more of a payment processing company, and the kind of infrastructure behind the payments that are taken once you tap your credit card or sign when you pay at the kind of at the till. So the way that I like to think about it, the way that I like to differentiate is when you look at your credit card or when you look at your debit card, you know, take one out of your wallet at the moment, you will have got the name of the bank or the building society, or maybe it's the maybe it's the credit card company, maybe it's actually a supermarket that you've got a credit card with, you've got their name on it. But also in the top right hand side, usually you have Visa or MasterCard or Visa debit. Yes, you can have American Express, but in the US, you can also have Discover. And they have the Discover Network, the Diners Club. They also do have a debit card as well. So massively subscale relative to Visa and MasterCard. But this is an important distinction, because bringing together these two companies, A, is going to create the largest lender to retail in the whole of the US, beating JP Morgan. So think about that in terms of the loan book, credit cards, short-term debt, repayable at the end of the month, otherwise the interest rate goes up, very lucrative business. But combining Capital One with Discover is going to create a kind of a slightly bigger rival to Visa and MasterCard, but it's still going to be relatively subscale. Two very different businesses coming together. By the way, there's a $1.4 billion breakup fee if this thing doesn't work out. But let's just talk very quickly about the deal rationale. So Capital One and Discover, why are they doing this? So obviously Capital One has been using, for its massive loan book, its massive credit card business, it's been using Visa or MasterCard to issue credit cards. Obviously Visa and MasterCard, the duopoly in this industry of payment processing, charge a fee. And their fee is not necessarily the most competitive fee. So if you also own a payment processor, i.e. Discover, then you can untangle yourself from the Visa and MasterCard duopoly and maybe get cheaper payment processing. This is what we would call, in the world of deal rationales, vertical integration. So the combined entity doesn't only manage the loan book, you know, the credit cards, people owing money month to month, but it also manages the payment processing behind that. Pretty smart. Other deal rationales, I mean, there's expected to be $2.7 billion of pre-tax synergies. Remember, synergies are the code word for benefits. So cost savings, so not needing to duplicate marketing networks, head office functions, etc.
Can I just ask on that point? So when the bankers are coming up with that figure, the synergy figure, you just mentioned what some of the inputs would be. How much of that 2.7 is accurate? Or is it kind of actually, once the integration begins, that figure's wildly off?
Yeah, it depends on what side of the bed you wake up as to how cynical you are. I think bankers tend to be very good at modeling synergies, but not necessarily as good at modeling integration costs. Right. So yes, 2.7 billion.
For a very clear reason, I must add then.
Well, absolutely. You know, again, it's relatively no-win, no-fee, and you know, you want the deal to get done. You want to push the deal through. And I'm not saying that this is the case, but one can very easily imagine a back solving. All right, here's a valuation that would work. Here's a earnings per share accretion that would work for this particular deal in order to have this really nice looking, forward-looking combined entity earnings. There needs to be a pretty chunky synergy line. So this $2.7 billion, so this will be really, really well logic and well thought through. But whether it's realized, you know, that's that's for the integration guys to deal with afterwards. So yeah, we'll take that maybe with a little bit of a pinch of salt, but there will be some synergies. And there will also, really importantly, be some economies of scale. And often we talk about economies of scale in the traditional sense that, you know, as you increase your output, your cost of each unit goes down relative to your increased output. But there's also an economies of scale, which is basically spreading your fixed cost base. You have variable costs and you have fixed costs. Variable costs are costs associated with actually producing another unit. Fixed costs are the costs that do not change if you add another unit on top. It's all of the SG&A, sales, general and administrative. So in the case of Discover and Capital One, they have a massive fixed cost base. IT systems, infrastructure, fraud protection, data gathering, data protection, cybersecurity, all of that stuff is going to stay fixed whether you have 100 users or 100 million users to a greater or lesser extent. Mm. So this is why, especially tech businesses, not that this is necessary tech, it's got similar dynamics. This is why it is so important for these businesses that have big fixed cost base to get as big as possible. Because you're spreading a big chunky piece of fixed cost across a much bigger network. So this is what, you know, this is another one of these deal rationales. And this is what you see across the tech space.
Yeah. And I'm assuming that, like with any deal, you strike at the best moment in time from a cost perspective, from overall transaction size. So is this good timing given the recent developments with Discover?
Yeah, so Discover's had a bit of a shocking year. So it's cheap at the moment. Share prices, well, before the announcement, was trading at a year low. It had a bunch of compliance lapses. I didn't read too much into them. But they as a result, they posted a 62% drop in fourth quarter 2023 profit. So yeah, any deal is good or bad depending on how much you pay. Mm. And Discover probably wasn't that good value for money maybe a year and a half ago. But now it's fit into that kind of, all right, Capital One's probably thinking a year and a half ago, we were probably roughly the same size. Now, you know, I can be the dominant player. You know, I can be the 60-40 owner of this combined entity. So yeah, there's definitely a timing thing. They probably would have had their eye on this strategic tie-up for a very long time. But then there's a trigger point that would initiate, you know, what is a really, really quite transformational deal.
Mm. And it being so transformational and so large, I'm sure the regulators then are going to be absolutely going through this with a fine tooth comb. So what's the antitrust position on this deal?
Yeah, I think there's a knee-jerk reaction from certain sides of Congress and the Senate that just say, look, big deal coming together, consumer facing, block it. You know, if big, then block. And that's what's already happened. There's been a couple of senators, including Elizabeth Warren, that's come out and said, look, this is not going to happen. You know, citing reports that say, well, like, the bigger a company is, the less advantageous it is to consumers over and above a certain level. However, the flip side, and this is what Ian Katz at Alpha Partners has been very vocal in saying, is, you know, what Discover is up against is a duopoly in Visa and MasterCard from a transaction and payments processing perspective, right? So I'm just looking at it here. I'm looking at a little pie chart that looks at transaction fees split across Visa, MasterCard, American Express and Discover. And Visa and MasterCard is about $9.1 billion of transaction fees in the US. Discover is $550 million. So it's just a completely different scale. And maybe if you're linking Discover together with Capital One, there's a little bit more financial firepower. They've got the credit card business, which is going to be able to generate profit to invest in the Discover network. Maybe that actually is going to disrupt Visa and MasterCard, which you can't be thinking, you know, Visa and MasterCard, over 80% of the market, you can't be suggesting that that is a really well-functioning market at the moment. Mm. So maybe this is a pro-competitive move as opposed to an anti-competitive move. And that is exactly what, this will get taken, you know, to the FTC. This is the argument that Cap One are going to be talking about. And the argument that the senators, all the kind of antitrust advocates are going to be talking about is, yeah, well, you know, payment processing, subscale, I get that. But combining the two entities together is still going to generate the biggest consumer loan book in the country. And we do not want that to happen. Two very different arguments.
Is there a way when it comes to antitrust side of things that you can almost do like a litmus test with a focus group or some body or entity to get a feeling of, like, it's almost like I'm a lawyer and I'm building my court case and I want to test out a few different avenues of attack to see what lands best? Is there such a process that exists for this type of thing with trying to guess what the antitrust reaction might be or what case would be most compelling to get through and past regulation?
Yeah, it's a really good thought. I don't know of any particular processes. That's not to say that they don't exist, and I am absolutely sure that the lead up to any particular trial or any particular engagement between the FTC and a particular company, they will be scenario testing, they will be focus grouping, they will be discussing, all right, what, you know, how should I lead this attack? You know, the classic way that you would do if it was in some form of courtroom drama. How am I going to get the edge here? And where am I really going to play? And again, the FTC will probably play on large loan book, and Cap One Discover are probably going to play on the duopoly of Visa and MasterCard. And maybe those are too obvious. Maybe there's another angle that could win the day. But yeah, there's definitely some smart people cooking up some nice strategies as we talk.
Cool. Okay. Well, look, let's move the show on to the second of the three topics. And this is one that certainly caught my eye as a headline, because I was kind of like, how has that come around? Which is potentially a larger scale IPO coming to London. So what's happened here with Shein, and what is that going to be the case, and why has it got to this, and what's it looking like? London and New York and other financial centers at the moment.
Yeah, so Shein, just as a reminder to the listeners, Shein is the very, very large private fast fashion company that's received valuations of upwards of $60-70 billion over the last year, one of the biggest private companies in the world. And their IPO has been hotly contested and hotly anticipated. But the problem is with their IPO and their desire to list on the New York Stock Exchange is that Shein is fundamentally a Chinese company. It's now headquartered in Singapore, but it's a Chinese company and it's got significant Chinese interest and ownership. And the mood music from the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, suggesting that Shein is probably not going to get approved for IPO due to the structure of its ownership and its links, again, getting a Chinese IPO away, quote unquote Chinese IPO away in the US market is very, very difficult. So New York Stock Exchange, it's the one that they want, and it's the one that Shein is probably going to land best on, let's be honest. But if I were Shein, if I were the investment bankers advising the company, I'd be like, look, you've got to be... Well, firstly, you've got to have some backup plans, right? So London, it's a backup plan. Hong Kong and Singapore, you know, they still have pretty big stock exchanges. They probably, you know, they're backup plans as well. What we need to figure out as kind of analysts is whether these are legitimate backup plans or whether they are simply kind of stalking horses for the New York Stock Exchange to get its act together and let Shein list. Like, do the New York Stock Exchange want, you know, are they going to pass up probably the biggest IPO of 2024? Let's be honest about it. It's probably going to be bigger than Arm as well last year. Are they going to pass that up for the sake of ownership and things, you know, and the link to China? Are they going to let it go to a rival stock exchange? Who knows? I get the impression that it's a stalking horse. And obviously we can go on and talk about just how unattractive London is as a place to list at the moment.
Do you think there's a sense of urgency with this, given the pending election in the US at the end of the year and a possibility of a Trump administration again?
Yeah, I think there probably is. And I think that there's a decent amount of urgency across quite a lot of waiting in the wings IPOs to get it out this side of the election, just for volatility purposes and for uncertainty purposes. More than anything, the market at the moment for IPOs is pretty starting to stabilize and it's starting to be pretty decent. So yeah, let's front load. Let's get this out there. Again, you know, who knows what's going to happen come November, but it's probably not going to be a better environment for Shein to try and list in the New York Stock Exchange. But then again, look, who knows? You know, we maybe I'm being too cynical. Maybe they do love London and they want to revive the ailing London stock market. Maybe they've got this kind of philanthropic bent towards the LSE.
So why is London like the sick man of all of these centers? Why is it so unattractive? And what I guess examples can you turn to kind of explain that with a bit more detail?
Yeah, I mean, it really is the sick stock exchange of the world at the moment. And you have this, and maybe it's because I am British and maybe I see things with a slightly different perspective, but you do have this kind of slightly legacy view that, you know, London is a real, you know, real financial hub, and the London Stock Exchange is the beating heart of that financial hub, and it's been around forever and it's such a powerhouse. But that, you know, the numbers do not prove that out at all. Just, you know, throwing a few numbers at you. So UK stock listings, IPOs, only just reached £1 billion last year of new stock issuances in the form of IPOs. That was less than 1% of worldwide IPO raising.
Wow.
And down from 14 billion in 2020. I mean, even that, raising less than £1 billion in one of the world's major stock exchanges is quite shocking. It's really, really bad. And why? I mean, you know, so number of reasons. You know, I don't want to talk too much about Brexit, but Brexit has put a massive drag on valuations and performance in our major indexes, right? So the FTSE 100 in the last 5 years is up 8%. S&P 500, 81%. The CAC 40, benchmark French index, up 50%. So if I am a company that's looking to maximize my valuation and then maximize my growth within that listed entity, within that stock exchange, and I'm looking at the relative performance, I'm thinking, gosh, I need to be on a rocket ship and the FTSE 100 is not.
It's still the imperial steamliner crossing the Atlantic.
Yeah, chugging away really, really slowly. And you know, and this translates into valuation. The price earnings ratio of the S&P 500 is 23 times at the moment, obviously slightly overweighted by the Magnificent Seven. But the price earnings ratio of the FTSE 100 is 10.5 times. So it's less than half as an average. You know, so this is basically, if you're looking for a bumper valuation, especially if you're more of a tech inclined stock, you need to be listing in the States. A, because you're going to get a better valuation, because B, there are more investors, there's more liquidity in the States, you know, full stop, right? But there's more investors in the States that understand the upside of technology relative to the UK, where the FTSE 100 does tend to attract more stable, slow economy type businesses. So, you know, it's also hard to list in the UK. The regulatory requirements are quite high. There's stamp duty on share transactions that there isn't in the US. So there's just this whole wave of different things that just make me think, gosh, if I was an exciting company, tech or otherwise, but if I was an exciting company, I would choose, and I had the option to list either in the US or in the UK. Obviously, I'm quite patriotic, so I might go UK, but logically, I'll go US.
So sometimes I hear people say that London is like a fintech hub.
Mm.
So, I mean, I know that you're quite informed on things like VC and startups, stuff like that. Are they two independent things where you can have a thriving fintech scene of smaller entities pushing boundaries, perhaps in certain technological areas? But we're talking here about large size companies listing. And as you rightly said, your measurement then of success almost is going to be tied to the broader index, of which is below performance by a significant margin. So is that right? I mean, to discount London as a place of forward-looking technology and things like that, of brain power, if you like, within that area, would it be correct to say that does exist? It's just that we're talking about a different thing here, which is listing an organization on exchange.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I would say, you know, I would always back the UK and more specifically London as a really, really good venture capital and startup scene, specifically fintech. The issue that we have, and it's a pretty intractable issue, is that the UK, from a venture capital perspective, is not a massive market. You know, 68, 69 million people, that's big. And you can do some pretty significant damage if you just maintain a UK presence. But if I'm a venture capitalist looking at my 100 bagger, I'm going to be thinking, all right, the UK is an absolutely brilliant place to grow and to test hypotheses. And, you know, there's the City of London and there's loads of major players. But as soon as you've got your proof of concept, well, as soon as you've got product market fit, which is the holy grail for startups, you're going to America. And you're going to try and get some traction in America. And if you get traction in America, we're going to list you in America because you get the best valuation. So this, you know, that is the standard playbook. You know, we are a good incubator, but we don't necessarily have the size of market. And therefore, we don't necessarily have the attractiveness of an exit that you would do in America. And I've seen plenty of companies just are basically forced by their VC backers to open up in the States, because that's where, you know, your market's 8 or 9 times bigger. Yeah. And therefore the economics can get a lot more exciting.
It's funny, in like the world of like arts and fashion, it's almost like a similar thing. You have London right at the cutting edge of a lot of the developments in these areas, like music, for example. And yet, unless you crack America, you've never quite really fulfill true potential.
Gotta break America. Yeah.
Never as big as they could have been.
Well, look, you know, it's, you know, referencing ourselves, Amplify, we're trying to break America at the moment. We've landed on the East Coast and we're trying to expand. I think we're going to the West Coast in March. So next week.
Yeah. So yeah, hitting University of California, Southern California, and Stanford. So yeah. Forward nice. To that.
Didn't get on that gig, unfortunately.
Neither did I. So we'll move on. So the role of an activist investor is our final one. And I know you're going to talk a little bit about Disney. So yeah, tell us what's going on with this Disney story then. There's our vehicle to explain the role of an activist investor.
Yeah, I thought this was a really interesting story from a kind of company strategy perspective, but also zooming out and focusing on the dynamics of shareholding and share ownership and annual general meetings and board members and things like that. So the story here is that Blackwells Capital, who is an activist investor, has urged Disney to appoint a chief technology officer in order to focus on a proper technology transformation. And their quote is that Disney will never be valued as a technology firm until it begins to think like one. So let's take a very quick step back and talk about Disney. Disney's had a pretty bad few years, right? You know, it had a botched transition from legacy management into new management. Then the legacy management came back to try and save the company, and that was botched as well. I think their share price, just remember the S&P up 81% in the last 5 years. Mm. Their share price is down 4.5% in the last 5 years, oh, right? Wow. That's a shocking. So whenever you get these dynamics of big companies that feel like they're being badly managed, remember big companies have, and their owners, and their, sorry, and their board, have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders to make sure that they are doing the best that they possibly can with the capital that has been given to them. So whenever there is a company that is significantly underperforming due to management, due to strategy, due to position within a market, then this is when the activists come in. Now, an activist shareholder of which there are some very famous ones, Bill Ackman, Nelson Peltz, etc. An activist shareholder will take a position, will buy shares in a company. Doesn't necessarily have to be a lot. I think Blackwell's Capital only have about $500 million worth of shares in, and actually, sorry, it's only $5 million worth of shares in Disney. You know, absolutely tiny. But that gives you a seat at the AGM, and that gives you a seat at the table. So it bought a very, very small stake in Disney in order to release a 60 page presentation that just said, look, this thing is being run terribly. We think it needs a CTO. We think it needs a board shakeup. We are going to take these proposals to the annual general meeting. So they're a shareholder. They're going to go to the AGM. They have actually tabled three new board members to come and sit on Disney's board to help give it a shakeup. Now, interestingly enough, at the same time, there's a much larger activist investor called Trian Fund Management, run by Nelson Peltz, who has also nominated two directors, and they've taken a $3 billion position in Disney. Disney has reiterated to shareholders that this is, they don't want to deal with the activists, they don't want to put any new board members on the board. But this is a bit of a fight, right? You've got the activists saying, look, Disney's being run terribly. Your share price is down 4.5% in a market that's up 81%. We think there needs to be some change. We're taking a position in this company and we're going to try and agitate. We're trying to be activists for change. Disney saying, no. You guys are just trying to make a fast buck or whatever. We've got our strategy. We're sticking to it. And it's going to all come out in the wash, probably on the 3rd of April at the AGM where these board members get voted.
It sounds like Succession, like playing out in real life, where they're going to that big AGM and they're all having these like backdoor meetings, trying to cut deals ahead of the AGM to see what gets said and who's aligned with whom. And
yeah, there's a lot of that. And there's a lot of ego and there's a lot of machinations and there's a lot of kind of internal politics. I was listening to a piece with Bill Ackman the other day, and he was like, I try to be as dispassionate as possible when I'm playing an activist role, because the only thing that I am seeking is a better outcome for the shareholders. I'm not trying to screw any, well, you know, he says he's not trying to screw anyone over.
I'm sorry, I have to stop you there. That sentence from Bill Ackman is absolute bullshit. That stinks.
Fair enough.
In the best interest of the shareholder, give me a break, Bill.
Well, look, I mean, he is a shareholder. So, you know, and I think this is very, it's important to distinguish between an activist that is taking a long position in order to agitate for change and an organization that is taking a short position because they believe that the company is fundamentally mismanaged or there is some kind of fraudulent behavior within that company. So they're still on the long side and they're still going, look, this thing is deeply, deeply structurally undermanaged or mismanaged. And we as shareholders are going to sort this out on behalf of us, the shareholders, and all of the other shareholders as well.
I think one of the things that I'm sure you're going to explain, but it sounds like what you're saying is that they want a CTO. How do you make Disney a technology company? Like, that sounds like a wonderful idea. But like, what's the meat on that concept and how do they think that they're going to achieve pitching or pivoting that business to be received by the investment community as, no, this is a technology firm?
Yeah, this is, I spent a lot of time trying to think about this. So yes, they want to position Disney as a technology firm in the same way as Walmart is looking at Amazon and thinking we want that sweet price earnings multiple that Amazon's got. You know, Walmart just made an acquisition of a smart television provider because it wants to take some of that high margin advertising revenue. So it's like, all right, we're all looking towards these 20, 30, times price earnings multiples and going, hey, I wonder if we could be a tech company. And now the intention is logical to go from being a 10 times price earnings company to trying to get a couple of turns up to 15, 16 times, and that's going to transform your company. Now, my big question is, one, can everything be, can you technology, you know, can you create a technology firm when the fundamental business model is not technology? You know, Disney, it's parks, it's entertainment, yes, it's Disney Plus, yes, it's media, but it's a pretty old school business. And when you try and, you know, when you try and pivot towards technology, do you lose the essence of your company? And is it actually the right thing for every company to try the kind of technologification of everything? Is it the right thing to do from a strategic perspective to hunt that price earnings multiple while slightly undermining the very business model that that took you to where you are today?
Yeah, I almost feel like, again, it's a time consideration, but as the world moves more in a technology direction via virtual experiences and virtual interactions, both in your personal and professional lives for people, that actually there's going to be an increasing value in having these experiences like what Disney World traditional parks might offer you for that immersive experience in person. I think that's going to have increasing value. But again, I see that's a long play. I guess the problem is here, the share price is getting nailed and they need immediate results, right?
Yeah, and they're talking about kind of hologram, you know, Disney hologram technology, and obviously right. There's a lot of AI in there as well. And what I was thinking about was like, okay, so if everyone's trying to become a technology company, is that just going to revert the S&P's price earnings back to a mean? Are the tech players outliers that are achieving a price earnings ratio well above the average of the S&P because they are outliers, because they are tech, because it's exciting? And if everyone levels up to that kind of excitement level in terms of the way their business model works, do we all start to become a little bit more sober and the price earnings multiple starts dropping across the board? Or is it that technology is fundamentally unlocking such value that the price earnings multiple will go up across the S&P and stay up? So you've got to look back into history and think, all right, you know, if every company becomes a technology company, you know, what does that look like from the price earnings of the S&P? And is it, you know, is it right that every company should try and become a technology company?
So when they talk about technology transformation, like having a CTO and a plan is one thing, but would this lead to, I mean, I'm assuming they're not in a position to make acquisitions, but is there some argument that an easier way to pivot when structurally you're not really aligned in that way is to have this vision, but then to buy in the parts you need?
Yeah, again, that's a very common play, legacy business buying a technology business to try and sass it up,
succession,
and their multiple. Yeah, Succession is exactly it, isn't it? Yeah. Maybe we can just go and watch Succession instead of doing this last part of the podcast. Yes, absolutely. Obviously, the downsides are, you know, the significant premium that you're going to have to pay for that technology business, especially as a legacy business, the integration costs. You know, the AOL Yahoo story, AOL Time Warner story was kind of the biggest example of value destruction, trying to merge together a internet company with a non-internet company. It's extraordinarily hard. Both of these things are hard. Acquiring to get a tech multiple and in an internal change process to get a tech multiple, extremely hard. Only very, very few examples exist of companies managing to do it successfully. It's often, you know, I don't doubt that we'll be here in 4 or 5 years' time talking about how Disney is trying to become a tech company.
So is there any like actual case studies of success or failure of these activist investors?
Yeah, it's a bit of a mixed record. And obviously failure can be A, all right, we didn't get the change that we wanted. Or B, we got the change that we wanted, but it wasn't the right change. Yeah. I like the Peloton example just because I think that Peloton is a really good company that was extremely poorly managed. So Blackwell's Capital, in the example of Peloton in 2022, owned nearly 5% of the company and put out a 65-page presentation saying that Peloton has been grossly mismanaged by a board that enriched themselves by selling $700 million of their own stock since the IPO. So they successfully made this case, ousted the co-founder, John Foley, and by the way, his wife, who was head of apparel, bit of a conflict there, and put in place a new CEO, a new board, and a new, again, sober, sensible way of growing the company. However, it's still down 65% in the last year. So I believe it was a success from a, all right, things need to change because this company is going down extremely quickly. But, you know, these things often take years and years and years and years. And maybe Peloton will either bought, which I think it probably will be, or it might go bankrupt before you can see the arc of change from this big shakeup actually come into play.
Yeah, you're going to need diamond hands if you're going to hold those Peloton shares down at whatever, $4 they trade these days.
Gosh. Yeah, no, that wasn't one of my best investments. This is not a podcast about investment advice.
Cool. Well, look, we will wrap it up there. Thank you very much, Stephen, as always. And again, if you are listening for the first time or indeed a regular listener, if you're not already subscribed to the channel, remember to hit follow on whatever platform you listen to. And click the bell. Normally there's a bell icon and you'll get notifications when all the new episodes come out as well. So again, Stephen, have a good week ahead and thanks to everyone for listening.
Thank you, Ant.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.